Welcome to the Revitalize My Church podcast, created to help churches navigate change and reorient to a new and healthy future. Here's the host of the show, Bart Blair.
This is episode 34 of the Revitalize My Church podcast. Thanks for tuning in. My name is Bart Blair. I am the director of church revitalization for a ministry called Assist Church Expansion. And we've been producing this podcast for about a year and a half now with the goal of helping churches navigate change and make their way to a new and healthy future. Thanks for tuning in. If you happen to be new to the show, we drop an episode on the 1st and the 15th of each month. The first of the month features a conversation between myself and the executive director of our ministry, Nathan Bryant. And we talk on things related to church revitalization, ministry, church growth, church replanting, you name it, things that we're learning, things that we're wanting to pass along to you, those who of you who are practitioners in ministry day in, day out, just trying to lead a healthy church. And perhaps you are navigating some sort of change in your church, and we just want to be a help in those things. On the 15th of each month, we feature a guest, someone that we're learning from. And today's episode is one that I'm really excited to share with you. It's a bit different than our normal episodes. I am sharing an interview with you today featuring a lady that I recently met named Amanda Purchase. Amanda is an occupational therapist. She's not a ministry leader, but I connected with Amanda through a mutual ministry friend who lives in the Houston area. And my friend Holly has a child with special needs. And she was sharing with me once some of the things that her occupational therapist slash friend Amanda had done to help accommodate their child in some church settings. And I thought, man, this would be a fantastic conversation to share with our audience. For those of you who've been listening to the show for a while, you might recall a book that I recommended earlier this year called The Dream Church. The author is Brian Moss, and I had Brian on the show earlier this year as well. And one of the conversations that Brian and I talked about was the fact that so many families in our communities have special needs children, some issue, some challenge with a child, and most churches are simply not set up to accommodate the special needs that families are looking for. And I think this is one of those areas that where you as a church leader might be able to find some differentiation between your church and maybe some of the other churches that are in your community. I'm not an expert in this. Amanda is. I hope that you'll find that this conversation is fruitful and helpful, or at least spark some conversation amongst you and your team about ways that you might be able to meet different needs for people with special needs in your community. So thanks again for tuning in. If you think that this episode might be helpful for someone else that you know, please make sure that you share it. And if you haven't ever left us a rating or review, would love for you to do that. Anyway, here's my recent conversation with Amanda Purchase. Well, Amanda, I'm so glad to meet you today and get to spend a little time with you discussing something that I think is going to be super helpful and super important for churches. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Super excited to talk to you about all this.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a very interesting conversation, a little bit different than what we typically talk about on this particular podcast. You and I have met through a mutual friend who that friend is also happens to be a client of yours, a client slash friend and a client slash friend of mine as well. And she was sharing some things with me that you had helped out with her and her family and her church. And she referred to you as an occupational therapist. And I was like, well, I've heard of that term before, but maybe I don't really know what an occupational therapist is. So why don't you start by just kind of sharing a little bit about who you are, where you are, and what you do as an occupational therapist?
Yes. So I am located in Fulcher, Texas, just outside Houston, about 30 miles west of Houston. And I have been an occupational therapist for, I don't know, close to 25 years now. And I've been around special needs my entire life. My mom was a speech therapist, had her own clinic in Dallas. So I grew up working in her clinic with children with autism and Down syndrome and cerebral palsy and ADHD and everything else. So it's definitely my passion, something that I knew from the time I was very young that that's what I wanted to do. And so now I actually have two businesses. One, I have my direct therapy business. So I work with children with autism, a lot of behavior issues, a lot of ADHD, a lot of high school boys who are trying to find their way in the world.
And a parent to those. So, yes.
Yes, yes, it's hard. And this could be a whole separate podcast, yeah. But you know, there's never been a more overstimulating environment for our youth, from pre-K kindergarten students all the way up through high school. And it's a lot of these kids don't necessarily even have a diagnosis or even misdiagnosed because they're just overstimulated in today's world. So as occupational therapists, I just like to say it could be difficult to explain because we do such a wide variety of things and there's so many different types of occupational therapists, but you know, we make life better. That's our goal, is we try to enhance life. We try to make life better. We help people to adjust to a new normal after an accident or, you know, life-changing situation. As far as my specific business, I help families navigate autism. I help them navigate brain injuries and just kind of what that path looks like, not just in the moment, but moving forward, because it's a very long journey. You know, it's not the type of therapy where you do, you know, twice a week for 6 weeks. You know, it's a lot of times I see kids for years and years and years. And that is, it's just the most rewarding thing. I just recently spoke to two kids who are now like 17, 18 years old, who I worked with when they were like from 4 years old to probably like, I don't know, 12 years old. So to hear from them now and hear how well they're doing and what they're doing and where they're going in the world. And just to hear, and I may tear up because I get emotional about this, but to hear from them now as older versions of themselves, of the kids I worked with when they were really, really struggling, and for them to tell me like the impact that OT had on their lives and how it just kind of guided their journeys, and that they still remember those things from when they were very young. I mean, it just gives me goosebumps, because I just, you know, it never gets old for me. I never take it for granted, the opportunity to make a difference in a child's life. And it's so humbling and such a blessing just to be able to show up for these kids and help these families to navigate this. You know, parenting does not come with a rule book, and parenting a child with special needs certainly does not come with a rule book. So it's can be a very exhausting, overwhelming journey. And, you know, these parents really just need someone to help them navigate the doctor's appointments, which specialists to go to, you know, the diagnosis, what types of therapy, when, right? Timing is everything, you know? So sometimes it's like, oh, we tried that, it didn't work. Well, maybe it wasn't the right timing. Maybe it wasn't the right connection. You know, you have to have chemistry with who you're working with, and families, the child, you know, and I mean, everyone, you know, across the board really has to work together well. And OT, I really love, because we kind of, you know, we work on so many different areas, from, you know, balance to coordination to visual perceptual skills to social emotional skills to, you know, learning to be, you know, to advocate for yourself to, you know, some of the, you know, working memory, and I mean, just across the board. So we're really able to coordinate and help to manage the care between like a neurologist and a physical therapist and a speech therapist and, you know, any other special pulmonologist, any other specialist that would be needed, you know, in these cases. And there's a lot that I'm leaving off the list there, but you know, for these families, a lot of times, unfortunately, they are kind of sent down a rabbit hole, like, oh, go see this person. This person's like, oh, go see this person. Well, now go see this person. And then they have all these test results, but they're very individualized and the family doesn't necessarily understand all of it. And so a lot of times I get people who come to me who are like, well, this is all the stuff we've done, but we really still don't know what to do with our child at home, or we don't know what school to send them to, or what's the best environment, or, you know, how do we set up a physical space at home? And so, you know, I will literally go through mounds and mounds of paperwork and piece out, you know, hey, this is important from this test, this is important from this doctor. And now, okay, now we have a full picture. And it may take parents, I mean, oh my gosh, like, I frequently see parents of children who are 15 years old and still don't really have answers, right? And so they have all this data, but they don't have a plan. So being able to take all of that data and help, you know, formulate a plan and perspective too, of like, hey, what's the priority here? You know, what's getting out of overwhelm, getting out of that stuck feeling of like, oh my gosh, we don't know what to do, so we just don't do anything, or we're doing things, but it's not the right things, or it's not the right timing. So that's kind of my role as an OT, is just to work with the kid on all of the, you know, fine motor and gross motor and handwriting, and, you know, being able to sit in a desk and a chair at a desk and attend to the task and complete the task without having a meltdown. Or, you know, for kids with ADHD, trying to navigate something as simple as completing a standardized test with fluorescent lights, you know, beaming down on your computer and the glare coming up and, you know, disrupting attention and focus. And these are very brilliant kids who have been told they're lazy or they're, you know, defiant, or because they're saying, I can't do it. And like, well, no, you're just being lazy. You're just being defiant. You're just being whatever, you know? And it's like, no, these kids are not lazy and defiant. They are truly ADHD. They are truly, you know, OCD. They are truly, all the things that can be going on that get dismissed for so long that you end up with very angry, aggressive, typically teenage boys who have just been misunderstood their whole lives. So frequently when I start seeing them, it's, I don't want to work with you. I'm not working with you. I'm, you know, an angry and aggressive and cussing and sometimes kicking and punching and throwing. And it's just, hey, I've learned that when I do this, then I stop going to this person. I move on to, you know, someone else because nothing has worked for them in the past. So, you know, just a lot of, you know, grace and patience and just showing up for these kids and saying like, hey, you can be angry with me, you can hate me, but like, I'm still here for you. I'm still going to show up for you and I'm still going to help you. And we're going to find ways to make your life better and to make this easier. And I'm going to advocate for you, you know? And so it takes, you know, it's really honestly doesn't take very long in the grand scheme of things, maybe 2 to 3 months. And these kids can like very quickly turn around. They just need someone who believes in them. And so I feel like, you know, as an OT, that's a really special role. And I think, you know, very easily can be a role that's filled by the church. It's just, you know, they just need someone to meet them where they are and say, hey, for you.
You're clearly very passionate about it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes.
One of the things that you said just a moment ago, Amanda, was you said that, you know, you're giving these kids hope and you're really trying to help the child. Obviously you're helping parents too. And that's a big part of it. You know, to sort of set up the conversation of where I wanted to kind of pick your brain today. I've never been in a church in my ministry life. I've been in ministry for almost 25 years, half of my life at this point. And I've never been in a church where we didn't have some families with some children with special needs, specifically children on the autism spectrum. Earlier this year, our listeners, if they're regular listeners, might remember a conversation that I had with Brian Moss, who's a pastor in Maryland, who wrote a book. And in his book, he cited some statistics about the families that we're trying to reach, the people we're trying to reach in our communities. And one of the statistics that he cited was the percentage of families that have a child with special needs. And it was surprising to me that it was basically 1 in 5 families. Now, that doesn't mean that 1 in 5 families has a child with autism or with ADHD, although I think that those are 2 diagnoses that we're seeing become more and more prevalent. One of the things that we know is a reality. I'm going to state 2 realities here, and then we're going to kind of get into how you can give not just the children, not just the parents, but maybe some pastors some hope, is that most families have a difficult time finding a church that can accommodate the needs of their special needs child, whether that's physical disability or some sort of learning or neuro disorder. Most churches have a difficult time finding Most individuals have a difficult time finding churches that can meet those needs. Second to that is the churches that we're typically working with and the churches that many of whom are listening to this podcast are churches that don't and haven't had a significant number of children in their children's ministry for a long time. And the reality is that if they're going to be effective at connecting with and reaching people in their community, they have to recognize that a significant percentage of the families that they're connecting with in their community are likely to have a special needs child. Now, a church that's, you know, 25, 50, 75 people that doesn't have any children or doesn't have many children who's looking to rebuild a children's ministry program, to me, and I shared this with you before we started recording, is that I think we're not going to be able to create a smaller church is not going to be able to create the Disney World experience that a lot of larger churches will for children's ministry. But one of the niches that we can create for ourselves in differentiation is being able to create a special needs ministry or at least a special needs space that allows families to find what they need in a church, in our church. So with that sort of setting the stage there for our conversation, Amanda, if I'm a pastor of a small church. I'm trying to connect with and reach families in my community. I recognize that there's a need in my community for some accommodation, some level of loving on, meeting these families where they are, creating space for them that's safe, that's welcoming. Where do I start? What are the first, you know, 2, 3, 4 questions that I might need to ask about myself, my church, our space, to set ourselves up to be able to meet and reach those families in our community who have children with special needs?
So first of all, I am a big picture person. So any statistics I throw out definitely should be should be fact checked, because I'm a big picture person. I know the rough details. But anyway, I think I told you before we started recording that, I think there's this misconception in the church and from a business standpoint, and it's not just the church, but schools too, or, you know, office spaces, whatever, that is very difficult and very costly to set up a special needs space or a sensory room or, you know, whatever you're aiming to set up. But, from my perspective, it's honestly very easy. And it's so needed. And so I live in Houston. And so those are the statistics I know. I just did this for a church who's considering adding a large special needs ministry to their church, or they're slowly working on it. In Houston, I think the statistics are something like 1 in 7 children have autism. So with our population, because we're Houston, we're the 4th largest city in the U.S., that means there's over 53,000 children with autism in the Houston area. There are only a few churches in Houston surrounding areas. So that's including all of our, within an hour and a half of Houston. There's only a few special needs ministries in Houston, and there's really only one church who has a true sensory room. So it's so needed. These families have nowhere to go. They really have very little support. They're exhausted. They're overwhelmed. They are in desperate need of respite care. They're in desperate need of support. They're in desperate need of community, companionship, anything. I mean, anything, So I think a lot of times these families feel so isolated, so alone, and yet there's so many families who could have a community if they just had a space to meet, right? So I think not getting stuck in the overwhelm of it has to be perfect. It has to be expensive. It has to be, big and large and Disney World, like you say. No, it does not have to. So I have another business called Sensational Spaces, and I work with an interior designer, and we design spaces for neurodiversity. Neurodiversity meaning autism, ADHD, dyslexia, dysgraphia, those types of things, OCD. So the beauty of that is we can go into a space and look at the existing space. And I mean, I think I told you this before, I've never been into a church where the existing space didn't meet the needs of the special needs ministry that would need to be started, right? So you don't always have to build on an expensive space. You don't always have to have an individualized space just for your special needs ministry. So many times we can find ways, I decide what goes in the space therapeutically, and the interior designer is able to look at it from a space planning perspective of, hey, we can easily incorporate that in this room that you already have, or this room you already have. And maybe it takes you 6 to 8 hours of, manpower of getting a few people from the church together to kind of move some furniture around, or, that type of thing. And you end up with spaces that are much better and much more effective, much more efficient than the space, the way you're using the space right now. So I think the biggest question is the biggest thing to start is don't overthink it. Reach out to someone who can help guide that, because it is very different setting up a space for a physical disability versus a cognitive disability, autism isn't even a cognitive disability, but just, with different disabilities, you need to approach things from a different perspective. Physically, but also from an environmental, sensory perspective. So it's honestly, these families are so desperate. It, even just having a space to meet once a week of hey, we're having community space, or, hey, we're incorporating some basic sensory equipment into our services, or we're going to have a more quiet room where we're going to, broadcast the service, via TV and audio. And so parents can come and go as they need to, or the kids can come and go as they need to, or maybe you have one parent in the quiet space. And then, after church, there's a, community, like Sunday school or whatever community space where there is just a support group, right? And then maybe you switch every week, you know, or one parent or the other parent, or, you know, obviously they're single parents. I'm a single parent. And so sometimes that can feel very lonely of like, you have these programs set up for like the mom and dad. There's not always, you know, you don't always have that. So just meeting people where they are. And I think just giving these parents, I mean, for a vast majority of these parents, having a special needs ministry would be like the only 1 hour or 2 hours a week where they have support and they have help. I mean, imagine the depth and gratitude that these parents would feel just having 1 hour a week to, you know, speak with and talk to other parents or other church members of, you know, not even about, you know, their child's autism or whatever, but just typical life stressors, you know, like how are you managing, you know, everything in your life, you know, but just having the space, the physical space, you know, to do that and the support to do that. So it really honestly can be very simple and it can be very easy. And a lot of times, like we just go through and do a consultation and just say, hey, based on what you have now, these are the things you can do and you can implement like today. And most of the time, you know, it can be free or very low cost. And then there's certainly, you know, people ask us, well, how much budget do we need? Well, you could spend $50 or you could spend, you know, $150,000. I mean, there's such a wide variety and, you know, you don't need really to spend anything. You just need to have the basic blueprint of the very basic things you need to have in place to support these families and to support these children.
Obviously one of the things you've talked about is designated space. And you've said that, you know, it doesn't always necessarily have to be something super special. It doesn't have to be large. What are some of the basics that are sort of like, well, you got to kind of have a few of these things and they're sort of non-negotiable? Beyond that, you can get as creative as you want. But what were some of the basic things that we would necessarily need to have?
So I think, you know, if we're talking about things from a neurodiverse perspective, which is, you know, when you look at like ADA, like the Americans with Disabilities Act, we have included those in building those adaptations and building codes, like, you know, you need to have a wheelchair ramp, you need to have elevator access for stair, you know, to avoid stairs, you know, you need to have a handrail for, you know, different types of things, right? So from a neurodiverse perspective, the ADA doesn't really add anything, right? It doesn't really protect people with autism or ADHD or migraines or, you know, whatever, OCD, you know. And so when I think of like designing for, you know, people with some sort of physical disability, we're typically adding things, right? We're adding a ramp, we're adding a wheelchair, you know, wheelchair access, we're adding, you know, whatever we're adding, grab bars, whatever. For neurodiversity, a lot of times we're deleting things, right? So we are, you know, dampening the audio, we're, you know, eliminating excess auditory input, we are eliminating excess lighting, you know, like a lot of times, you know, a lot of church services, especially the newer services, you know, we have like the cool bands and light shows and all that. Well, for people with autism and ADHD, oh my gosh, it's like, no, and I don't want to go to church here now because this is too overwhelming. It makes me want to run out of the room, right? So having a separate place where, you know, you can, you know, have the same service, but maybe you just have, you know, a service with less, you know, like if you have three services a day, maybe one service is lower lighting or decreased lighting, or maybe we don't have any of the strobe lights.
I'll stop you right there, because most of the churches that would be listening to this podcast are churches that, mm-hmm. in a lot of cases, they have none of that. They're smaller churches. They're doing one service on a Sunday. Oftentimes it's very stripped down with like a piano and a guitar, or maybe even using recorded tracks of music. So with that in mind, they're already ahead of the game. They're already ahead of the big mega churches, the rock band, the loud drums, and all of that.
Ideal. And by the way, that's not just for people with neurodiversity. You know, we always say when we design for neurodiversity, we really design better for everyone. So a lot of the accommodations we recommend, you end up getting feedback from the entire congregation of like, oh my gosh, I like this so much better. I feel so much calmer. It feels easier, you know, I don't feel so stressed out. Like it can be, we're living in like such an overstimulated world where we constantly have input bombarding our brains through technology and iPads and iPhones and, you know, noises and, you know, everything that it is. I mean, when I go to church, I want to feel calm. I want to like start my week with like, I feel calm, I feel peaceful, I feel less overwhelmed, you know? And so for the smaller churches, In my opinion, is actually can be a better space. So, you know, like, but just even, you know, looking at color schemes, looking at patterns, looking at, you know, in like the flooring, or even, you know, we tend to put a lot of things on the walls of like, oh, announcements here, or, you know, you have, you know, computer at the front of like, you know, putting up like the subtitles or whatever, which may be okay. Like, hey, you have that on the left side of the room, but you don't have it on the right side of the room. You know, very simple, basic strategies. And maybe, like I said, just adjusting the lighting or adjusting the acoustics or adjusting the volume of, you know, of the acoustics or whatever. So, and then, you know, past that, you can have very simple things like different types of seating, you know, flexible seating, or, you know, wobble cushions for people who need more movement, or, you know, fidgets that are, you know, simple and that are not, you know, people and kids who truly need fidgets typically are not throwing the fidgets, you know, they are using them to help them regulate, you know, so they stay in their laps or whatever, or, you know, just different types of seating, different types of, different areas in the church, you know, even if you have a small space like, hey, over here or in the back, maybe we allow some movement, or maybe up here it's, you know, quiet seating or whatever, you know, it can be, like I said, a lot of it is just deleting or eliminating excess overload. So I, like I said, in my opinion, like the smaller churches with, you know, less going on, for lack of a better word, can be a really safe space for people's
needs. Let's assume that, you know, I've got a smaller church. We've got a space that is actually probably more conducive for that. But we also, you know, we want to designate a ministry room. That's maybe not necessarily the sanctuary or the worship center. It's a ministry room designated to be used for families with children with special needs, you know, for lack of way of, I'll call it a sensory room, although it might not fully qualify as a sensory room. What would some of the basic things there be? You talked about having things on the wall or not having things on the wall, or lighting, like fluorescent lighting versus different kinds of lighting. If I just wanted to have a basic setup with a basic room, I couldn't spend a lot of money, but I wanted to at least start from square one, what would some of the things that I would want to do in that space be?
So I think my biggest thing when I'm looking at a space is providing flexibility and meeting different sensory needs, right? So you have maybe a tent or a, you know, some sort of area that's blocked off either, you know, through some sort of, you know, a lot of the younger kids like tents, like they think it's cool. And you have like, you know, or you maybe have a beanbag inside of the tent with like some cool, like LED lights, or maybe no lights, you know, depending on, or maybe you have LED lights in there with a remote that they can, the kids can choose what color they want, or no, you know, no lights at all or whatever. But a quiet, safe space where it can be completely secluded, even within the separate space. Right. And then you have kids who really honestly need a lot of movement. They need, you know, they need heavy work, which is like proprioceptive input. So things like trampolines, which I really honestly don't love the little miniature trampolines. They're loud. They're, I'm always scared that someone's going to get hurt or bash their face on the handlebar or whatever, but there's some really cool, like individual trampolines you can order that are just on the floor. They're maybe like, I don't know, 12 by 18, and they take up no space and they're inflatable, and you can deflate them during the week and, you know, reinflate them, you know, each Sunday.
When you say 12 by 18, you mean 12 inches by 18 inches?
12 inches by 18
feet.
No, not 18 feet.
Okay. It's like, that's bigger than the room I got. Clarifying.
And honestly, it's probably, I'm not good at spatial stuff. So I work with an interior designer. So honestly, now I'm thinking about it, it's not even 12 by 18. It's like maybe like 12 by 10, maybe, okay. You know, like it's not large. It's just a little like block, you know, or a little rectangle or little, you know, circle or whatever. You can get them in different shapes. But, and then like vestibular input. So like swings, which like you don't have to have, you know, can easily put an eye bolt in the ceiling in almost any space, as long as you're doing it safely. You know, you need to talk to someone who knows how to install sensory equipment, but an eye bolt in the ceiling where you have just one basic swing, you know, you don't need a whole lot of movement. So if it's a multi-purpose space, I would recommend actually having one with not a lot of movement, because from a safety standpoint, you don't want another kid getting bashed into by another kid on the swing. But like you could do a little cocoon swing where it's just, you know, basic, small movement input that's very regulating for a lot of these kids or adults. You could do a hammock, you know, that you string from one wall to the other. You could do like, compression things like weights or weighted vest or weighted blankets or weighted, like, you know, they have these cute like weighted puppy dogs or like lap mats or I mean, there's just so many things, like baskets of fidgets that you could do, card games, board games. I really, really like to include adults and teenagers in the neurodiverse planning, because we tend to build sensory rooms for toddlers and, you know, younger kids. And, you know, autism doesn't go away. You know, for a lot of people, obviously you make progress and, you know, as development happens, maybe needs change, but autism doesn't go away, you know? So, you know, teenagers with autism, adults with autism, they still need access to things that help them, you know, self-regulate, right? So it could be, you know, a big reclining chair or a massage chair, you know, that is age appropriate. You know, we don't want to provide the same things for adults that we provide for toddlers. You know, we don't want to feel like we're belittling or shaming people of like, oh, you can go in the sensory room, but it's filled with things for toddlers, right? So, you know, there are adult fidgets, there are adult weighted blankets, there are adult, you know, bean bags that like provide vibration, or you can even like pipe in like music through Bluetooth speakers in the bean bags that also provide vibration at the same time. So you're getting, you know, more individualized input where those people can have more control over like, hey, I like the vibration or I don't, or I like the music or I like the music and vibration at the same time, you know? So having flexibility in that space. And again, this is very dependent on your population, right? So you don't ever want to design a space, just a general sensory space. You want to design the space based on the people who are actually in your church coming to your church, you know? And if you are, if you don't have any people with special needs coming to your church yet, and then that would obviously be appropriate to design a general sensory space with some general things. But I would really wait to spend money on the equipment once you have, you know, whoever's actually going to be attending that service, you invest in the equipment that's going to be helpful.
That makes a lot of sense. And I guess the tension that we're in is, again, the churches that we're speaking to, the churches that are listening, are churches that are saying, we really do want to connect with young families in our community. We don't have those young families in our church. We want to create a space for them that's safe and welcoming and says, we see you and we recognize that you have needs that maybe we don't 100% relate to, but we want to create a space for you that's safe there. And I think some of the things that you've shared there are clearly some baseline things that I think are super helpful. And I think there's a pastor or a church leader that's listening to this and they're not really sure where to start. They should reach out to you, Amanda, or another occupational therapist in their community. The last question though, that I want to pose to you is less about the physical space and more about the culture of the community that you serve. When it comes to communicating to the public, generally speaking, to say that we have the ability to accommodate a family with a child with autism or some other disability or neuro disorder, what's appropriate to communicate? What's not? Like, if I want to put this, if we're going to create a sensory room in our church building, because we recognize there's a need, like I'm working with several churches right now that literally right next door to the church building is an elementary school. I know that these churches are doing things to connect with the teachers and the families in those schools. Those schools have kids with these special needs. If the churches next door had the ability to connect with and minister to those families and the school knew that, there would probably be a natural connection point there. What's appropriate for me to say? What's not appropriate for me to say? If I want to say, you are welcome here if you have a child with special needs. Like I don't, what's the balance there? What can I say? What shouldn't I say?
So I think these parents are so open and so willing to help educate and to, I mean, these parents are like jumping at the opportunity to say, this is what I need. This is what my child needs. If I just had this, we could come to church. We could be a family. We could be, you know, we could be present in your church. So I think the biggest thing is ask the families. I think it's like, hey, our church would love to start a special needs ministry. We would love to have a meeting, a Zoom. A Zoom may be better for a lot of these parents. It's after, you know, a lot of these kids don't sleep at all, to be honest, or don't go to sleep till very late or whatever, you know. So Zoom sometimes are easier for these parents to attend. Like, hey, we'd love to start a special needs ministry at our church. We would love to invite our community and talk about like, what are your needs? What do you need? Like, these families are so used to having to, you know, stay away from activities or try to go, you know, they'll plan, it may take 2-3 hours to plan to get somewhere, you know, and they may get somewhere and they're telling me they have a meltdown. And like it's hours of planning and hours of preparation only to be told, oh, like we can't accommodate that or we can't do this or, you know, and they think, oh, but this was a sensory friendly day, you know? Well, a lot of people, and I mean this in the best way, but a lot of people, a lot of organizations, a lot of businesses are really trying to meet that need now. And having these quote sensory friendly days or sensory spaces, you know, and it's just not done well, right? It just misses the mark. It just, a lot of times it ends up being more overwhelming or more overstimulating because like they're trying so hard, but if you don't really know what you're doing, it's pretty easy to miss the mark, right? So, but if you're talking to someone like an occupational therapist or, yeah, I mean, really OTs, we're the experts on sensory stuff. So that's who I would recommend speaking with. As far as I know, I think we're the only business that incorporates occupational therapy and interior design, which is just a magical combination because we're able to look at environments from all angles and very quickly come up with a plan and blueprint, literal blueprints and, you know, CAD drawings, whatever else people need for their project. But getting input from the families, I think is like the most beautiful, most genuine thing you can do of like, hey, we know it's okay to say, we know we don't know what we're doing and we want your input. Like we want to build our special needs ministry for the children in our community. Right. So like, if you show up to this meeting, please give us a list. What does your child need? Does your child need movement? Does your child need quiet space? Does your child need headphones? Does your child need, you know, a lot of times, like we go to these sensory events and it's like the same things. It's like, it's the same pair of headphones. It's the same, you know, like, and the parents are like, we have all of that. We, you know, this is what we really need, you know? So I think these parents would just be so happy for someone to say, hey, what do you need? How can we help meet your need? How can we serve you? What do you need as a parent? What does your child need? And then I think the thing that's missed the most, or maybe that's not fair to say the most, but like all the time, is the siblings of the special needs children, right? The siblings who already are missing out on so much or are sacrificing so much. And on the flip side, they're also learning so much. They're growing so much. They have like this incredible aptitude for empathy and connection because they've had to do that, right? But like having a space for these siblings with special needs children to where it's like, hey, even if your parents have to go home, hey, we have a trusted place where you can stay for an hour or two and you can have community with your friends or with, you know, elder people in the church or teenagers or whatever, of like, hey, we can meet those needs, you know? And then I think too, a really beautiful way to do this. And like I said, mental health for all kids, especially teenagers right now, I mean, it's at an all-time low. And it's very difficult to know, how do we turn that around? What can we do? And for me, what I see as the biggest impact for teenagers is service hours, because it is so hard for them to get out of their bubble. It is so hard for them to get offline. It is so hard for them to have perspective in this age of social media. And most of these teenagers need service hours now. You know, they're trying to do it for graduation and maybe it's required or whatever. And so it starts out as what requirement. I'm like, ah, you know, I'm a teenager. I don't want to go. I'd rather be doing this. Or I'd rather be doing this. And then it's like literally the first opportunity where they get to go and serve in the special needs ministry or work with these kids. It is the most beautiful thing you've ever seen, because the kids with special needs benefit, but I honestly, like, I see more impact for the kids, like the teenagers who are doing their service hours. And I mean, 95% of the time they come back and they are excited, and it just gives them this different perspective. Like, you know what, maybe that comment on social, on Instagram didn't mean that much, or maybe that like on social media didn't, you know, wasn't necessary. Or maybe it's just this perspective, like, oh my gosh, like I am like walking and eating and breathing on my own. And it's just like the basic human existence that it is so hard to teach kids without that perspective, you know? And so then it's not necessarily like, I think from a, you know, from a business standpoint, from a budget standpoint, you don't necessarily need to pay people or hire volunteers. Like you have high school, you know, kids who are willing and ready, and it makes the biggest impact on them. And then maybe they end up, you know, bringing their kids there to church at 10 years from now, or, you know, and it's just like this ripple effect of this whole community connection and enhancement and ways that just aren't really happening otherwise, you know, like they're not happening in school. Like a lot of schools have like that buddy system. It doesn't seem to be like, you know, COVID obviously changed so many things, but I don't see a lot of other opportunities. So like the special needs ministry is like such a cool and again, free way for, you know, the churches to have people, have volunteers. And for these kids, you know, who are teenagers who are struggling with mental health, it's like completely changes their outlook and perspective on life. And just to see the relationships that develop between the volunteers and the kids, and then for the parents to know, like, hey, my kid is like so excited to go to church because they know, that person's going to be there, that volunteer is going to be there week to week, and they're excited about it. I mean, it's just like the most beautiful thing all the way around, you know, so it really comes full circle, and it really meets so many needs on, you know, financial standpoint and connection standpoint and service standpoint and just all of those things, you know, and just a basic faith standpoint, you know, like Jesus didn't ignore the people with special needs and the sinners and the, you know, the people struggling with mental health. You know, he served them, he met their needs. So it's just like, let's just go back to the basics of like, let's just serve people, like show up and serve people and say, hey, we're here. What do you need? You know, it's really as simple as that for me. And if you talk to these families, it's like, that's all they want. Just ask me what I need.
You know what? And that, Amanda, is a perfect place for us to end this podcast. Because at the end of the day, you're right. That's really all it is. We're here. We're called to serve. We're called to love our neighbors. We want to love our neighbors to a place where they know Jesus and love Jesus the way that we do. And this has been super cool. I really appreciate you you hanging out with me today, giving me a lot of really interesting ideas. And I'm sure that those that are listening to the show. Again, this is a different conversation than what we typically have on this podcast. So I appreciate you being willing to kind of step into a space that's a little different for you.
Yeah, no, I love it. I am super passionate about it, obviously. And it's just very cool. It's very cool to see so many more churches, attempting to start special needs ministry. And feel free to reach out. I'd love to help out. So
absolutely.
But I love to be here.
Yeah, we'll include links and all your contact information in the show notes of the episode. And I do want to thank you for taking the time with me today. For those of you who are listening, who've made it all the way here to the end, thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Revitalize My Church podcast. Remember that we drop episodes on the 1st and the 15th of every month, which is always really difficult to remember. So the best way for you to make sure that you don't miss an episode is to subscribe wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. That way they get delivered to your mobile device as soon as they come out. And Amanda, thanks again. Appreciate it. And for those of you who have been listening, thanks again. We'll see you soon.